An economist and a lawyer walk into a room. This isn't the start of a bad joke. It's an integral part of FINRA's rulemaking process. At FINRA, economists and lawyers work closely together to ensure that FINRA's rules are as effective and tailored as possible. On this episode, we are joined by Phil Shaken from FINRA's Office of General Counsel and Jonathan Sacobin, our chief economist, to learn how this process works. Welcome to FINRA Unscripted from Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Caitlin Kiernan. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by two of FINRA's finest. We've got Jonathan Sacobin rejoining us today as a refresher from our first episode. Jonathan is FINRA's chief economist. And we've also got Phil Shaken here for the first time. Phil is vice president and associate general counsel for FINRA's Office of General Counsel's Regulatory Practice Group. Jonathan and Phil, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Terrific to be here. Thank you.
Now, our listeners may wonder, what do an economist and a lawyer have in common? Why are we bringing them together here today?
It's a punchline to a bad joke, right? Yeah, we just need like a pastor or a priest. We'll get everybody.
And if only we relocated to the bar for the rest of the podcast.
I didn't realize that was an option.
Both Phil and Jonathan and their teams have important roles to play in FINRA's rulemaking and retrospective rule review processes. So today we have Jonathan and Phil here together to help fill us in on how those processes work, because unfortunately for all Americans, Schoolhouse Rock failed to follow up on their 1976 hit, I'm Just a Bill, with the natural follow-up, I'm Just a FINRA Rule Proposal. So you'll be relieved to hear I'm not going to ask you to sing today, but I am going to start with this. From start to finish, what does the rulemaking process generally look like? And Phil, maybe you can kick this off.
Sure. I really do wish we had a Schoolhouse Rock song to describe
Zero
it.
Is my hero, yeah.
Right, in a catchy and fun way, but I'll try my best to at least give a sense of the process in an informative way. I guess one thing I'd say at the outset is that we know that our rules have significant impacts, not only on the investors that they're intended to protect, but also on the industry and potentially on the capital formation process. So we try to get this as right as we can right from the get-go. And our rulemaking process is really designed to ensure that we have really well thought out rule proposals that are informed by all interested stakeholders and that are narrowly tailored to solve the regulatory problem that we've identified. So it's a multi-step process. Not every rule goes through all the steps of this process. We have all kinds of different rules, some very technical in nature, some very sweeping in nature, but the majority of the significant rulemakings will cover these major steps. So first, the staff will try to develop the proposal in consultation with various stakeholders, including industry representatives and FINRA advisory committees. One of the advantages, for those who are not familiar with our advisory committees, being a self-regulatory organization, is that we have at the ready expertise from industry experts and others to help us inform our rulemaking and to identify regulatory problems in the first instance. So we have something like, I think, 15 standing committees. Some are subject matter committees. Some are based on firm size or business model. And also importantly, we have an investor issues committee that's composed of notable investor advocates. So we will bounce our proposals off these committees and we'll take their feedback in and refine the proposals. And then the next step is to take a more formalized proposal to our board in hopes that they will approve it for comment. And at that stage, we'll inform them of the kind of feedback we receive from the committees. And assuming that they approve the rule proposal, the next step typically would be for us to put it out for public comment in a regulatory notice. And that's really the first of what's typically two opportunities for the public to comment on any given rule proposal. That's usually out for comment for about 60 days, and the staff will then read and analyze all the comments and make changes to the proposal as we see appropriate and consistent with the regulatory objective. And then the next step is to submit the proposal to the SEC for approval. The SEC essentially has to approve all of our rule proposals, and they have their own process that they go through. It also includes another round of comments. So they publish the proposal in the Federal Register, and there's that second bite at the apple for the public. And again, FINRA staff will look at those comments, make any amendments that we think is appropriate, and then hope that the SEC will approve. And assuming that they do that, which isn't always the case, but usually the case, we will announce the approved rule in another regulatory notice that will also typically include the implementation date and increasingly guidance in the form of FAQs.
When you say public comment, that's anyone out there?
That's right. It's posted on our website for all to see, and we regularly get comment. Of course, the industry is most interested in the trade organizations, but we hear from individuals, we hear from law school clinics, we hear from investor advocates, we hear from the state regulators sometimes. So it's completely open to anyone who has interest in the proposal.
And is there ever substantial changes made in response to those comments?
Oh, all the time. Often when we're developing rules, we come from the perspective of what we know, what we hear, we go out, we talk to people, we go through this process that Phil's talked about. But often there are pieces that we may not know all the information that we need to know. So part of the process of going out in a reg notice is to ask questions. We put out options, we ask questions, we seek feedback. Phil was really kind to me when we started this conversation by talking about all the economics associated with rulemaking. And in some sense, the formal part of doing this kind of economic analysis is fairly new to FINRA, but FINRA's always had to think about who it was going to impact in its rules, how it was going to help investors, how it was going to make sure that markets are working well. And so it's really often that we'll hear something that maybe we didn't anticipate. It's hard for some firms, given their business model, to apply a process. And if you made this change, it would be much more easy, it would be much more efficient, and you'd still get all the protections that you're looking for investors. That kind of feedback is incredibly helpful to us because we can calibrate, we can arrange, we can create flexibilities where it's appropriate. We can do all kinds of things to ensure that we meet our end goal, which is making sure that investors are protected and that markets are functioning really well, and do it in a way that is the most sensible.
And I imagine sometimes lawyers have a different view on things than the economists. What happens when that's the case? How do you work together?
Yeah, I usually bring chocolate. That's a good start to the conversation. Oh, go ahead, Phil.
No, and that's very persuasive. I think we see eye to eye on more things than you might think. As Jonathan said, the sort of economic impact's always something as a policymaker, and that's what I think of us as lawyers in this organization. It's always been something that we've considered, but we have good spirited discussions as we do with other of our colleagues in the organization.
Yeah, so these are different disciplines. We ask different questions. We come to the same problem often from different directions. And having conversations, we ask lots of stupid questions. Some of the stupid questions actually get us to a smarter place. Not all of them. We totally admit it. Sometimes we frustrate our legal colleagues by making them teach us the law. Sometimes we frustrate them by making them learn some economics. But between the two efforts, at the end of the day, the conversations always help us get to a better place.
Jonathan, you mentioned that FINRA is still relatively new to including this type of economic analysis. Can you tell us why and how this has shifted?
FINRA only started doing these economic analyses about 5 years ago when I joined, and in part because FINRA doesn't have a direct legal obligation to do so. The SEC does and has taken that seriously for a long time, and for 20 plus years has been developing and redeveloping and refining its approach to doing economic analysis. And so when I joined, we had this opportunity to rethink how we sort of incorporate what we know and what we don't know into the rulemaking process. I think our constituents more and more expect and demand FINRA to go through the process, the sort of the disciplined process of saying, all right, explain to us really what's going on here. What's the problem you're trying to solve? Who's being harmed? Why can't markets sort of figure this out on their own? And what did you guys consider? What are the options? Who's going to be affected by any particular regulatory solution? And that sort of disciplined approach, I think, helps us be sharp in how we create, develop, and publish rules. It helps us be a lot more disciplined in the kinds of questions that we ask, which gets us better feedback. Phil is, I'm not sure if he agrees with that statement or not. But I think what it does is it sort of enhances the dialogue between us internally and with our public stakeholders in a way that makes our rulemaking more effective, hopefully.
So, Phil, do you agree? Does it get you better feedback?
I think it does get us better feedback. I feel like it's brought a structured thinking to something that we had sort of been doing in a more informal way or innate way.
Inchoate. Yeah, absolutely.
Not inchoate. I'd say just less formal, but these were always the kinds of questions and issues that we wanted to surface. But I do think that it helps us think about things in a more structured way and that that does often generate better feedback.
So, Phil, where do you get the ideas for new rules?
Okay, so just to be clear, it's not just me who generates the ideas. And I might even reframe the question as to sort of how organizationally do we identify regulatory problems that might be appropriately addressed with rulemaking? Because I don't want to give the impression that we sort of sit around and brainstorm where can we do rulemaking next. And it really comes from any number of sources. So, of course, we've got a lot of operational programs, right? So things that we see in our exam program, things that our enforcement program sees. We have a lot of data analysis in the organization. So we have people who are looking for trends that come from customer complaints and arbitrations that are filed. Our advisory committees are always a source of what's going on the ground. Sometimes there are task force that will generate recommendations. Sometimes there's legislation that's dictated to us. So there's any number of things that might be an impetus for rulemaking.
So I'll give you a practical example. So rulemaking should be in constant improvement cycles. Some of the changes are because of technology. Some of it is because business practices have changed. Some of it is because there are new bad practices that have sprung up that weren't contemplated in earlier versions of the rule. So a really simple thing. There's been a rule on the books for I don't know how long that's required an FA to sign in ink when they're given the right to make certain decisions on behalf of their clients. But there's now electronic versions of signatures. And in fact, the rules permit e-signatures by the clients, but we've never sort of gotten around and said, you can use an e-signature for the rep. So that's something that's not a huge rule. It doesn't change the world, but it does make things easier. It does put us more in line with the way businesses work. There is no particular risk to investors in moving this particular signature. So that's something that we would say, let's do a rule.
If only we had a process to look for those kinds of things.
Well, in 2014, FINRA began a formal process of retrospective rule reviews. Jonathan, I know you lead a lot of that. So can you tell us why this initiative was launched and what kind of the goal of it is?
So before we talk about that, I have to say the reason that Phil is here with me today, the reason why we are here together is because he has been instrumental. He has been our key partner in this. We've developed the process together. We've spent countless hours talking about how this process should go, how to do it. And it really reflects the deep partnership that my office has with OGC, particularly around this initiative. And I can't stress that enough, because to have an effective review, you have to be willing to look at lots of different things. You can't look at the economics without thinking about what the law says, what the law is trying to do, how this particular rule fits in with a whole lot of other rules that are already in the books. If we didn't do this together, we wouldn't be nearly as effective as we are. So with that as background, let's sort of step back. You can't expect a rule that was written 35 years ago to be well calibrated for the way the world works today. One of the things that regulators are really good at is writing a rule, declaring victory, and moving on. One of the things that's really hard for a regulator to do is to step back and say, okay, what did we do? How well did it work? Did it do what we expected? Can we do it better? How has the world changed? And so the fact that FINRA has actually made this very large effort to step back and think about retrospective rule reviews, I think is incredibly cool. So what do? We say, where is there an area? It could be a single rule. It could be a group of rules that are related, that have been on the books for a while. And how well are they working? Are they still well designed for the way the world is designed today? And it's not only about the rule itself and the words in the rule. It's how are we administering it? Are there ways that we can make it more effective and reduce the burdens so that in the end, there is as much, if not more, protection for investors, and it's easier to achieve? We want to try and make sure it is as easy to protect investors as possible, because the easier it is, the more protection investors actually get.
And so how do you determine what makes a good candidate for your review?
You want to take a first shot at this, Phil?
Sure. So that process is a lot more art than science. We don't have a real rigid structure by which we look back at every single rule at a precise interval. That's just not an effective use of our resources, among other things. So much like the retro review process itself and the rulemaking process itself, we try to get a lot of feedback from our stakeholders. So we're constantly asking our advisory committees, what rules are they struggling with or what rules do they think would be ripe for review? And we'll tee it up at conferences and other forums.
The engagement notice was a really good mechanism to put this out there and look for a wide range of parties to give us feedback on the retro review process.
Right. But there are some other factors that we do think about, as Jonathan sort of alluded to, you know, rules that we haven't sort of taken a hard look at in a long time that haven't been out for public comment in some time. We look to our internal operating departments as well. So we have a member relations department that's been very close contact with the membership. We want to hear from them. What are they hearing that firms maybe are complaining about? In OGC, we handle most of the interpretive requests related to the rules. We look there to see where do firms see ambiguities in the rules? Where are we getting general calls about? What might the exam program, again, be seeing? I mean, we've got a lot of operational programs where the management there is in a great position to see sort of what's working and what's not working. Now, there's some consideration as to whether there's actually an opportunity to change the rules if we go down that road. So sometimes we hear everybody wants to change the AML, anti-money laundering rules, but that's something that we implement for the Treasury Department. So that's not one that's really probably a good candidate for review.
So what are some of the possible outcomes of your review?
That's a great question, because we were talking recently. We've now done 5, 6 of these things, and almost every one has had a very different kind of outcome. So, for instance, Phil was talking about sort of an older rule set that's worth going back to. One of the first retro reviews we did was on advertising regulation, and FINRA had a bunch of rules from the 1980s about having to review ads on basic mutual funds. Things that are really sort of considered vanilla and low risk. That's one where we went through and sort of said, well, maybe we can rethink everything that needs to be reviewed and reduce the number and types of ads that need to be reviewed. We had another one around our membership application process, which had been changing and evolving, but it was really important to get a lot of feedback. And there, what we heard was, the rules are basically good, but you guys need better technology. You need a better platform to interact with member firms, and you need to make sure that your processes are consistent and well understood. And so we had an opportunity to get a lot of feedback and figure out how we can improve without changing rules.
So that's an improvement in our internal processes versus the rule itself.
Like that's right. Yeah, it's about the administration of the rules and not the rules themselves.
I would add that the communications with the public, some of the outcomes there are also illustrative of something Jonathan mentioned earlier about moment in time versus evolving technologies, for instance. So some other things that came out of that review. One was we had a systems upgrade. Part of the advertising review program is they look at websites. And until this system upgrade, in order to look at the websites, a firm would actually have to convert every page to a PDF and then send it through system. So now we have a system where they can file the web page in so-called native format. We also took the opportunity of that review to issue additional guidance on how our rules apply to social media and mobile, which were really not contemplated when many of the rule provisions came into effect years ago.
OBA, outside business activity, is also a really good example because that's one where we really ended up rethinking the regulatory basis for our rules. So that's a case where you have FINRA registered persons who are doing other kinds of activities. So they could be selling insurance, or they could be acting as an investment advisor, or they could be working as an Uber driver or working at Target over the Christmas break. We heard all kinds of things. Our favorite story was
goat farming.
Yeah. We heard a lot about this goat farmer, and why should the goat farmer's boss have to approve that kind of business? Here was a case where we came out and said, you know what? If there is another regulator for those activities, then that's who should be regulating those activities. We were able to sort of rethink through this core way that we regulate broker-dealers and come out with something that's still out for comment, but that we think sort of made more sense given how the regulatory environment had changed over time.
So just to wrap up, do other regulators do this kind of exercise?
Not in the way that we do. It's very common to have 5-year or 10-year review. The SEC does it on a regular basis, but they don't put the kind of resources that we put into it. They don't think about things as holistically as we do generally. And I think as a result, we're far more dynamic in the way that we do our retro reviews. And I think other regulators who we talk to view us as sort of more on the leading edge of this space.
And Phil, you mentioned the engagement notice. I know that one's expired now, but are you guys still accepting feedback on ideas for reviews?
Absolutely. We're always interested in ideas that anyone has for retro reviews or any other regulatory initiatives for that matter. So anyone who has them can certainly feel free to contact Jonathan or me or really anyone in the organization.
See, I was going to say that you should feel free to contact Phil or me, but you know, that's how it goes.
Well, thank you both for joining us today to help shine some light on how this process works. I feel like I learned a lot, and hopefully our listeners did too. Maybe next time we can have some musically inclined coworkers turn this all into a song for us. But that's all for today. I'm Caitlin Kiernan from Washington. If you have any questions for future guests or ideas for future episodes, let us know. You can email us at finraunscripted@finra.org or reach out to us on social media. Until next time.
Please note, FINRA podcasts are the sole property of FINRA, and the information provided is for informational and educational purposes only. The content of the podcast does not constitute any FINRA rule or amendment or interpretation to such rules. Compliance with any recommended conduct presented does not mean that a firm or person has complied with the full extent of their obligations under FINRA rules, the rules of any other SRO, or securities laws. This podcast is provided as is. FINRA and its affiliates are not responsible for any human or mechanical errors or omissions. Parties may not reproduce these podcasts in any form or reference them in any publication without the express written consent of FINRA.